Welcome to episode 10, the season finale of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I am film watcher Greg Ralph.
Season finale, Greg, of season 4.
It blows my mind. It really does. Well, hey, we might be a success story now. I don't know.
It's been quite a long season because we've had to do it all through this pandemic, in quarantine, out of quarantine.
Gosh, Ricardo, what an amazing segue into our theme this time. Why don't you tell the folks at home about it?
Well, this is our back to quarantine episode.
And just to then explain the next level of detail, regular listeners might recall that when we got caught out by the pandemic, like the rest of the world, between seasons 3 and 4, we decided to try something a little different. And we set up what we call the Friday Quarantine Film Night, where each Friday for 10 or 11 weeks, we recommended a short film and then a feature film that people could watch and maybe comment about on our Facebook page. The thing was that in the main, these were films that we hadn't reviewed before. A couple we had, but most we hadn't. And so we thought that given that, you know, traditionally, if you can say traditionally after 4 seasons, traditionally we end the season with an episode that really focuses around, you know, cinema and the film watching experience, we decided what we really wanted to do was to take 3 of those feature films that we hadn't reviewed before and look at them afresh as part of the rounding out, hopefully, of Lockdown City.
So the first film we're going to discuss is 2010's French comedy, The Heartbreaker.
And then we're going to hop across to Japan and review 2008's film, Departures.
And then we're going to round off this episode with 1946's A Matter of Life and Death.
So 3 films, 3 countries, separated a little bit in time. But I have to say, this is an episode that I'm particularly looking forward to because I'll sneak preview, spoiler alert, I like all these films.
So Greg, why don't you just kick off the episode with talking about Heartbreaker?
When I first saw this French charmer around the time of its 2010 release, I thought, this is what Hollywood has forgotten how to do. A fresh-feeling, charming, believable rom-com. It gets both parts of a rom-com right, the romance and the laughs. I've seen it 4 or 5 times so far, and it gets me on both counts every time. The story begins with a highly amusing vignette and then a montage that shows us the unique consultancy provided by Alex, Romain Duris. He's paid by a woman's relatives or friends to intervene when they believe that she's in a toxic relationship. Alex works with his sister Melanie, Julie Ferrier, and her husband Marc, François Damien, to create a brief encounter, to drop an artfully designed, ideal romantic man into the woman's life, inspiring her that she can do better than her current beau. Screenwriter Laurent Zeton got this idea from a cousin's situation, when he told his uncle they should hire an improvisational actor to split up the couple. Alex has scruples. He will only break up a couple when the woman is clearly unhappy. But his ethics are challenged when he's contracted by the father of Juliette, Vanessa Paradis, to stop her impending marriage to Jonathan, Andrew Lincoln. The problem is that Jonathan is an ideal himself, despite the best efforts of Alex's team to determine otherwise. Yet Alex can't afford not to take the job, as he's pursued by impatient moneylenders who threaten violence. So he turns up as Juliette's new bodyguard during her final wedding preparations in beautiful coastal Monaco, trying to charm her away from the marriage while, you guessed it, falling in love with her. Much of the comedy comes from the ways in which Alex's team manipulates Juliette's circumstances to prime her to fall in love with him, tailoring for her love of such things as George Michael songs and the film Dirty Dancing. And then the comedy shifts up a gear when a rogue element arrives for the celebrations. Juliette's full-on party girl buddy, Sophie, Helena Noguera, who holds the key to a mystery gap year in Juliette's past. It's a beautifully constructed story with a lyrical ending, capped off with an amusing postscript during the end credits. There's even a reversal of the rom-com tradition of a mad dash to the airport. The characters are believable, and each is given their moments to shine, with some running jokes about each member of the team, while Juliette is the heart of the story. Perhaps I should be quietly relieved that Hollywood hasn't attempted a remake of this French comedy. as happened with Father's Day, Dinner for Schmucks, or Stallone's Oscar. Although I am quite partial to The Birdcage and True Lies. But trust me, this is the best rom-com that you've never heard of. Ricardo, would you agree?
Yeah, I really love this film a lot. Look, it never takes itself too seriously. The performances are fantastic. Romain Duris, ever charming in that role. He's so, so good. But I tell you, Vanessa Paradis is also quite wonderful. I mean, she's quite cold for the first part of it, but when she starts sort of warming to him, she starts glowing, and the end is just so lovely. But Romain Duris, if you're a lover of dirty dancing, you know, you'll get a lot out of this film because there's a segment in there paying homage to that movie, and he's just brilliant, and it just makes me smile from ear to ear.
Well, I, as I said, I've seen this film four or five times, but only this week, for the first time in preparing for this podcast, it's the first time I've ever actually watched Dirty Dancing. It just passed.
That's amazing. That's such a confession, really.
Yeah, and I actually told someone today, and they were staggered. But you know, it's a testament to the film that you don't have to have seen Dirty Dancing to find the film delightful. But
no,
now
you
having
don't.
Seen that, I get more what it's doing in those moments. But it's just a standalone, perfect little, you know, crafted film.
It is. It is. Look, there's so many great moments in the film. It's one of those films where I can watch, you know, quite a few times. And we have here. I just don't get bored of it. You know, I thought I might on this one. I thought I've got to watch it again. But from the very beginning, I loved the opening section.
It's like the beginning of a James Bond film
where you get this little
self-contained story.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's very funny as well. But you get this little contained story that entertains in its own right, but then sets you up for what's going to come in, you know, the main story.
You're watching it going, hang on, is this the rom-com I'm about to watch? But it's the perfect setup for what
it
they
is.
Are doing. Testament to the screenplay as well, not just the direction of it, but the screenplay hits its beats all along for a classic rom-com. It's not schmaltzy. It's not saccharinely sweet. You know, it doesn't do what sort of American rom-coms do. You know, like her husband, or husband-to-be, really, is not a bad person. You know,
no, he's a genuinely nice, wonderful guy.
He's a nice guy, but you just, what it's saying is that he's just, you can just tell he's not right for her. He's not a bad guy. So I almost felt sorry for him. I did feel sorry for him at the end, but,
yeah,
you know, but it's a rom-com and we know what's going to happen. So it hits all the beats, but it does it in such a good way.
And the second tier characters are wonderful as well. I had totally forgotten that whole story about the best friend, or the old friend, Sophie, who turns up.
She's
totally
great,
forgotten
actually.
Her character.
She's great.
Very good.
I'll tell you it can be a bit brutal.
You have to treat it like a Looney Tunes cartoon at times.
You have to, because, you know...
And you have to put aside any ethical concerns about someone getting paid to break up a relationship.
That's right.
You just have to park that for the purposes of the story. I mean,
you do.
That's what it is.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, all the second-tier characters are wonderful. So the sister and her husband.
Fantastic.
And there's a great running joke about the sister they're in a hotel, who just keeps popping up as a maid and a barmaid and a receptionist. She speaks fluent Chinese to some tourists. And there's this minor character who's the hotel manager or assistant manager who keeps wondering who she is because she does all these different jobs and he doesn't know who she is, but he's not quite prepared to say so.
That's
like,
right.
It's hilarious.
Oh, it is hilarious. There's
but
all
it's
of that
not just
externally yeah. from the main plot. Like, it's really good.
And you haven't mentioned his little routine about how he can cry on command.
Oh, when he's got a whole performance routine.
A regular script that he plays with.
But then he has to cry on cue. And this face he pulls.
He turns away towards us.
And with this sort of pain, sort of wanting to cry look. And he can just do it. He's very good. But it's so funny. You know, his looks are hilarious.
But it's not just the comedy. I mean, there's one scene that, again, I'd forgotten about, but really struck me this time around. Just before, you know, the final action, there's a scene where everything comes undone. There's five characters in an elevator. Something happens. Everything is revealed to Juliette, as you kind of would expect. I won't say what happens, but something happens. And four of those five characters are all, you know, exchanging glances of, you know, oops, or no, this is not as bad as it looks versus, you know, betrayal or something. And that scene is without dialogue, and it just works.
The film
can move between comedy and something deeper.
That scene in particular is so well done. It's so well directed. It's very well shot. And the performances, I mean, it's like there is a script there with the looks to each other.
Yes.
That you know exactly what they're thinking. I mean, what brilliant performances there, but also the direction in getting those and the way it's shot. It's a silent scene, but it's full of dialogue, you know.
You don't need words.
Yeah, you don't need it. And so it's intelligently made. That's what I love about it. There's a few different other scenes I really loved in it, which really made me laugh. There's a really great scene where Juliet is with Sophie at a classical concert, and she doesn't know he's there, but they notice that he is there, and obviously he's playing the part. And he's looking at the concert and playing the piano, sort of miming the piano, and as if he's so into it, he knows exactly that they're in it together. And it's so funny. It's just really hilarious. Great moments all the way through it.
I've got a fun fact for you. The pianist in that concert scene is actually Caroline Dehuy, who's the sister of Romain, Alex, and appeared in that scene as part of the film.
Oh, fantastic. I love it when those things happen. I love it when you...
You know I do. That's why I look them up.
If you haven't seen this film, just do it. It's a really enjoyable one. You can just watch it one night with anybody.
A glass of wine.
Yeah.
And just settle back and love it. And I find it's a really great film to recommend to people. So, you know, in my now profession as a professional podcast film reviewer, people do ask me about, you know, what I'm watching or what's worth watching. And I recommend this film, and 9.5 times out of 10, people haven't heard of it. And that would be the one benefit of remaking it in Hollywood, if they did it well, and they could well not, is that the film's just not that accessible anymore. It's hard to find. You can find it, but certainly in Australia, it's missing from most of the streaming platforms.
And it was on there, then it went pretty quickly.
Yeah, and so...
it was on the streaming.
It can be a little bit hard to find, but it's worth it, even if you have to sort of shop around on the net to get a DVD. But it's a lovely film, and look... If you, in the slightest, like rom-coms, I reckon I can guarantee that you will really like this film.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Ricardo, out of 10?
I'm giving it a 9 out of 10. You know, I was watching it and I was thinking, what am I going to give this? Because I was just loving it again. And I thought, well, there's not much wrong with it. It's quite flawless in the way...
Well, there's nothing wrong with it, actually.
No, there's nothing. You know, in terms of its genre, it's perfect. And... and I was thinking, you know, it's not classic material of When Harry Met Sally or one of those, you know, real classics, but it's up there. And so I just thought, no, I've got to give this a 9 out of 10. I can't fault it any other way. So, yeah.
Well, snap, I'm a 9 for this as well. It's funny. It warms the cockles of your heart. When they do that moment from the Dirty Dancing routine, you almost want to cheer. Like, it's just a really... lovely, lovely film. It's not a great film, not a masterpiece, but it's lovely.
And even the Wham sequence, you know, when they're in the car and...
And she's in cold mode.
Yeah, she is. And he starts singing
and then they hijack the car radio to play a Wham song because they know she likes Wham. And he's singing along and getting into it, even though he doesn't actually like Wham. And she's all cold, but then she turns to the window and she just kind of
starts mimes part of
the lyrics, and she's really on a high but hiding it. And
again, it's brilliant. Beautiful moments. Really good moments.
Another good thing about this film, this is a really good film for how character shows action. So when she turns to the window and you can see that she's actually, you know, into this, but she's not showing it.
Yes.
And even the first time that Sophie arrives, and I'd totally forgotten the Sophie story, which is wonderful. Yeah. When they sit, and Juliet is a wine expert, by the way. When they sit down for wine at the wedding venue to try the wine and the food and so on, Juliet's there sipping and savouring, and the white wine is beautifully almost lucid in the glass, and Sophie's just guzzling it down, you know.
Yeah,
that tells you about their characters, you know.
It does.
It's just really well thought through. It's craft.
It really is craft. I mean, this, like I said before, the screenplay is fantastic. It just hits every beat. It's quite perfect and quite flawless.
Well, for our second film from last year's Friday Quarantine Film Night, we're going to jump back 2 years and across from France to Japan. Ricardo, why don't you tell us about Departures?
Directed by Yujiro Takita, This 2008 film follows Daigo Kobayashi, Mashiro Motoki, a cellist musician working in an orchestra. After purchasing a new expensive cello, he is told that the orchestra is disbanding. It's obvious that the attendance numbers for their performances are quite low. Following this news, he and his wife Mika, Ryoko Hirasu, move back to his hometown where they now live in his childhood home that was left to him after his mother's passing 2 years earlier. The place is fronted by a coffee shop that Daigo's father ran before having an affair and leaving with his new lover when Daigo was only 6. Not having had much contact with his father since, Daigo still feels hatred towards his father and guilt for not taking better care of his mother while she was ill. He even has trouble remembering his father's face. However, he still keeps a stone letter, a textured stone which conveys meaning, which was given to him by his father years earlier. Now out of a job, Daigo begins to look for another and stumbles across an ad for what he thinks is a travel agency due to its description that he would be required for departures. This is, however, a mortuary. The ad mistakenly should have read, departed. In the interview with secretary Yukiro Kamimura, Komiko Yo, he learns that he'll actually be preparing deceased bodies for cremation in a lovely ritual known as encoffinment. His new boss, Sasaki, Sotomu Yamazaki, thinks he has all the right traits to do this job and hires him straight away, even offering him a cash bonus. Now, needing to do the job, he accepts it, reluctantly, however hides the details from his wife, Mika. His first experience at the job is not nice. However, the more he does it, the more he respects and honours the job, finding a comfort with his profession. After work to clean himself, he visits a public bath owned by Tsuyoko Yamashita, Kazuko Yoshiyuki, the mother of one of Daigo's former classmates. His new profession, however, is not liked by everyone, and in particular Mika, who calls him unclean and wants him to find another job. He refuses, and she leaves to stay with her family while he makes a decision. But he continues with it and also begins to play the cello again. When Mika returns pregnant a few months later, Daigo also gets the news that he must prepare an encoffinment for someone he and Mika know. Here, he earns the respect of Mika, who can now see that he is great at what he does. Now, I don't want to go into too much on how things end, because it is quite beautiful.
Yeah, don't.
The film is very well directed. Director Takita really lets the actors perform here, holding on them to get their fullest expression. The performances are all great. The cinematography by Takeshi Hamada is so nice to look at also. For a film that really centers itself around death, it has so much beauty. The music by Joe Hisaishi is also a standout, and the montage sequence with Daigo playing his cello amongst the mountains is just so lovely to watch. It is, however, too long. At 2 hours and 10 minutes, I felt there were moments that could be cut back, particularly the actual rituals of the deceased. Now, I understand that seeing this in full when he is learning to understand how lovely it is in the first half, you know, we need to see that. But we did need to see it over and over again with the different families in the second half. I don't think the story itself really needed to go beyond 2 hours. So I got a little bored in the second half, and it also didn't really connect with me emotionally, which was really quite surprising. But the ending was really lovely. Look, I know this film is loved by a lot of people. You know, it won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film and swept the Japanese Academy Awards. I didn't love it, but I liked it a lot. Greg, what do you think?
This is actually Japan's first foreign Oscar win.
Yeah, wow.
So it was big stuff in Japan. Yeah. I actually had a different experience to you. This is the second time that I've watched it.
Yeah.
The first time would have been not long maybe after it came out. And again, I couldn't actually remember a lot of the story. I remembered more the experience of the film, which was that I had been very moved. And again, it's been a film that I've recommended and given to people on occasion for birthdays and so on. And I actually had probably the opposite experience to what you've described for the second half.
Mm.
The montage where he plays the cello outdoors and you see, you know, a montage of different funerals at which he participates, I had tears just running down my face. Not sobs, but just this sense of depth of sadness. And I actually really disagree with you. I do think the film is slow, and I do think it's too long.
It's not that it was too slow, because the story is, I just felt the story, and it's pretty much the simplicity of the story. I mean, it's not that, you know.
I don't think the film's too slow. I think it is slow, and slow for some. I view that more as being, you know, elegiac rather than slow.
Yeah. I just think those sequences, to watch another one in the second half, another long moment of him doing the same thing over and over and seeing the other family grieve again and doing, I just think we saw it before. I understand when it comes to people.
I disagree.
I understand with the scene where Mika and Diego know the lake. I'm not going to go into it too much, but that's a massive moment. And so I understand that. But before that, to see it over and over and over again, yeah, I just felt there could have been some cutting there. And I think if it had been on 2 hours, it would have been perfect.
I got a lot out of that scene over and over again. And it's an unusual film and an unusual ritual, which I understand is only done in some rural areas of Japan. It's a bit of almost a forgotten art, which the film sort of brings back into the general consciousness. But I found the way the different families reacted and the beauty of how what they did brings a corpse back to something recognisable as their loved one, their mother, their son, yes, whatever.
And that's beautiful.
And then all the emotion pours out of the family, sometimes negative emotion like anger, and arguments and whatever else, but also, you know, the embracing or the silliness when one family puts, you know, big red lipstick marks all over the face of the patriarch.
Yes.
You know, there's actually different responses that I actually think are part of the craft of the film. I certainly think it is a little bit too long. I do think some people will watch it and find that it's just not their kind of pace. But no, I like it. I just got so much out of it. And a lot of that was just my emotional response to the film. It's funny in parts too. This is a film that actually moves really nicely. I actually find that the deftness and the beauty of what they do in that ceremony, you know, the kind of the manneredness of the hand movements, it's almost like dance. And I find that reflected both in the performance of the cello, the way the hands move playing the cello, but in fact also the performance of the director and the writer.
Yes.
The way that the film moves in moments of sorrow. And then something funny happens, particularly his first day. His first day when he's filming a demonstration video of No Warning in a kind of an adult nappy.
Quite hilarious.
The first body he attends, when there's a detail on the body that, let's say, they weren't expecting and how they respond to that.
That's right.
And then there's a horrific moment when they go to collect an old lady's corpse that's been undiscovered for 2 weeks, and you just get the flash of a glimpse of it. It's pretty horrific.
Yes, it is quite horrific.
But then he slips on some squishy fruit, moldy fruit as well. Like, it really deftly moves between the two. Now,
after that day when he goes home and Mika's cooked him a nice meal and he looks at the chicken.
No, she hasn't cooked it yet. She hasn't cooked it yet.
No, it's sitting there.
It's a raw chicken chopped up.
A raw chicken. And he's just
complete
like,
with head. But listen, let me tell you a personal story I don't think I've told you before.
Yeah.
So many years ago, I'm talking about 30-something years ago, I worked in the health and safety sector.
Mm.
And I had to do this project in the funeral industry. Now, when I say I had to do it, in fact, the project fell over before it really got going. And I have to say I was infinitely grateful because I was really dreading this kind of thing. Sure. But I did a lot of pre-reading and went out and did a site visit to the back of house at a funeral home and so on to get ready to do this project. And I read some pretty horrific stories about the different states that the bodies can be in, depending on where they were found, how long since they died, a whole raft of stuff, the manner in which they died. And I'm not going to, you know, put our podcast listeners off by going into particular details. But I understood, I think, exactly what he was experiencing. And I could relate to it as well. And the fact that they could build humor into that moment with the two-week-old corpse was just so beautifully done. And there is a real sense of master craftsmanship throughout this film.
There is, and you can tell that.
So the cello playing. By the way, he wasn't a cellist. He learnt to play the cello for this film.
Oh, that is amazing. It's a hard instrument to learn, and it's such a beautiful instrument. Oh, it's one of my favourites.
There's that particular theme which they play particularly during that montage scene that we've been talking about, that is just a lovely, lovely piece. And
it's beautiful.
For me, the cello in this film and the cello music, they represent memory and they represent reflection. And I think loss, you know, or the beauty of the life and death cycle. Like it's the absolute right instrument for this film and for that
absolutely.
Piece of music.
And the way it's made, and like I said in my opening piece, there's so much beauty in a film that essentially is about death. And you're right, the way they make up in that beautiful ritual, I mean, it really is a delicate, gorgeous ritual, you know, they do.
And something which is so foreign to me and a lot of people to be, like, I am not someone who likes to go to a body viewing.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I was a bit traumatized when I was 14 by being taken to one of those, my grandfather, and I hated it. And I never want to do one again. But there is something beautiful about, it's not so much about preserving the body, which is the way I understand what we do in the West.
Yeah.
It's actually about reclaiming the personality of the body before the final send-off. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it really is.
I don't know if I'd want to go to one, but I really respect it.
Oh, so do I. And I think, you know, that's what Mika comes to understand.
Yes.
And that's such
a beautiful
moment.
The grace, the dignity, the gift.
Absolutely. You know, and I love that those moments of the film. I loved the relationship between Mika and Diego. I thought that was really great.
Even the moment when a couple of times you see him trying to remember his father before he left and all he sees is a blurred face. And Motoki, the lead actor, he's very good.
So expressive.
Yeah. Now, I have some fun facts for you. Do you know where he started his career?
No.
He was in a boy band called Shibugakitai, maybe, that was very big in the 80s. And then when the band broke up, that's when he turned to acting. And he did a comedy as a Zen monk, apparently, called Fancy Dance. But this was his big break. But this film was 10 years in the making. And it was partly because he went to India.
10 years in the making, doesn't surprise me,
yeah. Yeah, he went to India, Motoki, and read a particular book and then came back raving about it. And over time, that became the film Departures. And originally the protagonist, you know, his character was just a bar owner, but then they changed it with the whole backstory about being a cellist and how he came back to his hometown because the director so much wanted that music as being really, you know, spot on for the kind of story they were trying to tell.
Yeah, and little moments as well, like when Mika buys an octopus and it's alive and he tries to keep it alive, you know, but it dies. There's little moments like that. This is life and death, life and death. It just keeps bringing you back to that.
Yes,
you know, even
and that
death,
all food is death.
Yes. Yeah, it's well crafted. Well crafted. It's just that it didn't hit me emotionally that I thought it would, and I thought it was just a little bit long. But I did like it a lot.
Well, it as I say, it really, really hit the mark for me. And I'm giving this, again, a 9 out of 10. It really moved me. I don't think it's for everybody. I think that they're going to find it, some people are probably going to find it a bit too slow. You have to sort of enter into the spirit of it, but I think it's beautifully crafted.
I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10. It just didn't get to me emotionally, which I just want a film to do, and especially of this, to get me emotionally invested completely, and it just didn't, and I just found it a bit overlong in that second half. So I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10. I know a lot of people love it and probably completely disagree with me and completely agree with you, Greg, but that's what I'm going to give it.
Just before we wrap up, Ricardo, I've got one more fun fact for you. And you know
okay,
I like
sure.
my fun facts, right?
Yeah, go for it.
So one of the really interesting things about this film is that there are a number of, shall we say, characters who are dead. You know, the bodies that are encoffined, and there must be like 8 or 10 of them maybe across the film, maybe more.
Yeah, that's right.
They needed people who could lie incredibly still, even when they're being moved around and things put towards their noses and so on.
Well,
and so
one thing I was thinking during those whole sequences is how good the makeup is of the characters. Because, you know, if you've seen, you know, a dead body, it's very, they got it really right. And so they do look deceased. So and also the stillness of them. So keep going.
Yes, well, so I will. So what they did was they went through a very lengthy casting process to find actors who had the ability to just play dead, basically, to lie as still as possible.
Wow,
and that was fine for all the bodies bar one, because one of the bodies is also a character, you know, alive earlier in the film.
Yes.
So they had the actor who was playing that character, but who wasn't terribly good at playing dead. And they, first of all, they tried to find a body double, and they couldn't find one that was close enough to follow that strategy. So what they did in the end, and I suspect you might understand this better than I do, because I'm reading here, is that what they did in the end was that the crew used digital effects to transplant a still image of the actor during their funeral scene to make it look realistic. Now, I read this after having watched the film, you know, most recently. I feel like I need to go back to that scene and actually see what they're talking about, because it sounds like they had like an extra who could lie still and then projected her image onto it or something. I don't
quite
get
that. Yeah, that's interesting. Oh, I'll have to have a look at that and see if I can notice anything digitally on it. But that, otherwise, I think it was done very well, if that's the case.
So like the original intention of our Friday quarantine film night, this now becomes all about audience participation. Fun challenge. Go find the film, watch that scene, and see if you can work out what the hell's going on.
And now for our final film for season four, Greg. 1946's A Matter of Life and Death.
Well, this film was chosen for the first ever Royal Film Performance in 1946. It was written, produced and directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, the extraordinary duo who wedded art to cinema. They were behind such visually stunning classics as The Thief of Baghdad, Black Narcissus, The Red Shoes and Tales of Hoffman, as well as the quite different 1966 Australian film, They're a Weird Mob. I have very fond memories of this particular film, the first feature that we programmed in last year's quarantine film festival. Ricardo hadn't seen it, and I was really hoping he'd like it. We had one of my favourite conversations, long into the early hours, excited by how much we both loved this story and the visual sensibility with which it's told. And Ricardo's response reminded me very much of when he first saw Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, coincidentally released over the same Christmas in 1946. Like Capra's film, A Matter of Life and Death starts deep in the galaxy, through which the narrator takes us on a leisurely tour back towards Earth. Through the fogs of the English Channel, we encounter Peter Carter, David Niven, an RAF pilot returning from the fall of Berlin's bombing mission at the end of World War II. Both his plane and his parachute are broken. Before jumping from his plane, Peter has a final conversation with a UK-based American radio operator, June, Kim Hunter. They fall in love over the air, but Peter has to jump to his certain death, only he doesn't die. He's missed in the fog by his heavenly escort, Conductor 71, Marius Goring, an aristocrat guillotined during the French Revolution. Peter washes up on shore, convinced he has died and gone to heaven. Once he realises that he's still alive, he finds June and they become a couple. Meanwhile, there's consternation in the afterlife, when an invoice discrepancy of all things reveals that one soul was not delivered. When Peter is told of the error by Conductor 71 and asked to go on to the afterlife, he refuses, on the grounds that he's found love and has the right to enjoy the fruits of their error. While Conductor 71 goes back to negotiate on Peter's behalf, June becomes concerned by his solo encounters with the afterlife. Her friend, Dr. Reeves, Roger Livesey, examines Peter and diagnoses a brain injury as the source of his visions, but these are so real to Peter that he must be cured with urgency. The film obscures the truth of Peter's experiences. Is he actually the fortunate survivor of a celestial error, or is he having epileptic visions brought on by his miraculous fall? It's left to you to choose which version to believe. As a sentimental romantic, you can guess which version I believe. The movie advocates for the positive collaboration of different cultures to build a better world in the wake of war, notably between Britain and the US. We see this theme represented throughout. The central love story is between a British man and an American woman, where the Brit gets the girl. American soldiers and British servicewomen and a vicar collaborate on a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, while American jazz is played under the watchful eyes of Elizabeth I's portrait. and the celestial trial for Peter's future becomes a debate between the prosecutor, Raymond Massey, and the defence about the value of British versus American culture. The film was originally suggested by a British government department to improve relations between UK-based Americans and a British public that was wearied by bombings, rationings, and having to put up with Americans who were overpaid, oversexed, and overhere. As with so many Powell Pressburger films, there's a striking vision exercise throughout, including a large Hitchcock-like model of closing eyelids. But most notably, in a reversal of The Wizard of Oz 7 years before, Earth is shown in colour with a black and white afterlife. The celestial scenes were filmed in three-strip Technicolor, but without colour added during printing, giving a pearly hue, perhaps for the pearly gates, to these sequences. This is an effect lost in commonly available DVDs, so I've just ordered the 4K digital restoration on Blu-ray from the Criterion Collection, which promises to restore these visuals to their original glory. It must have been amazing for an audience to be immersed in this story so soon after the war's end, an audience who had experienced great loss and who would be seeking consolation and meaning. And so I'm back in my mind to It's a Wonderful Life again. Surely a companion piece to this film. Ricardo, did the Powell Pressburger film hold up to a second viewing for you?
Absolutely. It's so clever and so beautifully realised. The fantastical elements are just so ahead of its time. You know, I mean, look, I know that there was The Wizard of Oz at that time as well. It came out in 1939. So we had that great fantastical elements of that. But this is different, and this came straight after World War II. From war to finding love again, it's a perfect film for me.
It is art, capital A.
It is art, and it's just so clever. The screenplay's clever. I mean, the courtroom scene talk at the end between the prosecutor and the defence is brilliant. It's so well done. The staircase to heaven. And in fact, that was the title in America, Stairway to Heaven.
Do you know why?
Why?
Because the American marketers, who were both fairly new at the game, felt that a film that had death in the title would not sell in the American market. And when Powell and Pressburger retorted by saying, well, there'd been a big hit a few years before called Death Takes a Holiday that had done very well. Mm. And the response of the marketers was, yeah, but that was Death Taking a Holiday, so there would be no death in the film. Like, it was a real thing. And it reminded me a bit, you know, sometimes these films talk to each other. It reminded me yes. of the response to Departures, that there was a real feeling that it wouldn't do well because it's all about death. But it's a consoling film. It really is.
Oh, you know, yes.
If you'd lost your son or your husband or your daughter or whoever in war, the idea, and I think this is what It's a Wonderful Life does as well, the idea that there's an afterlife that where you will be happy.
Yes.
Your lost loved one will be happy is a very powerful thing. And the fact, it's interesting that both of these things start in the galaxy, in the cosmos, both these
It
films.
Does. Yeah, both of them do.
The Capra film as well.
That's right, it does.
One is like an angel or possibly Ben Franklin talking to a junior angel. And this is, you never find out who the narrator is. I don't even know whose voice it is. But who sort of draws you from almost these warning signs in the galaxy. Like here's a planet that blew itself up with a hydrogen bomb. This is just after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for example. Yeah. Like there's a lot in it that for us, there's a risk with this film now. Particularly maybe with the DVD versions, that it seems a bit quaint, like of the past.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a quaint film, but I can see that would be there for some people. But for the audience at the time, in a cinema...
Straight after that happened?
It might have been 18 months. It must have been overwhelming.
Absolutely. And the thing is...
And very emotional.
It also brings on, soldiers back from war, the visions, the trauma they must have endured at that time as well, in terms of Peter's visions and whatnot, what he's having, after war. And I'm sure there would have been many of that with soldiers coming back and then the horrors they witnessed. The performances are great. David Niven is just wonderful. I love June. The whole love story is started when he's dying and they're having a, he's going to die. He's going down in a plague.
That's the one scene where I don't like him. When he's the jolly fly
really?
Boy and all upper lip, stiff upper lip. I just found that a little bit forced.
No,
it's once,
I didn't.
It's after that scene. I mean, I get the setup for it and so on, but you know, I just found that I didn't quite buy into that.
No,
but
I did.
Absolutely.
I still think it's a very good scene. You see why they fall in love when they find each other. She was there, what she thought was in his final moments, and they just got along so well in that scene. And then when they find each other, these two characters can't be apart now. They've just shared something so beautiful.
Yes, I agree.
They can't be apart.
And powerful.
So you're talking about the visual aesthetic of the film, the color, technicolor to the black and white.
Lots of really strong close-ups of different characters.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting because another film I really love, it's one of my favorite films, is Wings of Desire, and Wim Bender's film. And they use black and white in the angel world and color in the real world as well. I think a lot of directors would pay homage to this film, after seeing it. The angels,
which is pretty big of Bender's because he's German.
Yes.
And you notice there are no Germans in heaven.
Yes, that's right. Exactly, there's not. I actually didn't even think about that.
Well, with the exception of Conductor 71, who was very French.
Very French.
The rest of them, I think everyone else pretty much is American or British.
That's right. But
except for
the courtroom, there's a lot of different ethnicities in the courtroom.
There is
the
jury, but in the assembly, were there?
Yeah, there was. There was lots of different ethnicities in there.
Right. Anyway, it was meant to be the whole of humanity who had died and gone on.
That's right.
It was meant to be in this assembly.
But I just love that massive courtroom, which echoes the ancient Greek theatre. I just love it.
It's got a real sense of scale. And I remember when we had that conversation after you had seen it for the first time last year, all these afterlife scenes. You know, there's those scenes where they kind of look down through the holes sort of in the floor.
Yes.
Down to earth. That felt almost... Yes. Look, I'm not an arts student or anything, but... it felt a bit like German Expressionism or something. It was a real sensibility to it.
There's not any film really like it. And
no.
And I love the way Dr. Reeves puts it at the end. He says, "On Earth, nothing is stronger than love." You know, that whole end sequence, when he's put on trial, she's put on trial, and that whole section, and when they all come down from heaven on the staircase down, and they're watching the operation, and that actually echoed all that jazz a little bit for me.
Oh yes, yeah, I can see that.
And
Powell and Pressburger have been very influential on different filmmakers, on Scorsese.
Yes, I know that. And look, I've seen The Red Shoes, and it's another visual delight too.
Well, I've got some fun facts for you.
Please
about the set. So first of all, that part of the afterlife where those huge circular observation holes are sort of in the floor kind of.
Yes.
And then you can see down onto Earth through those.
Yes.
Well, that design became the inspiration for the creation of a UK bus station in 2004 that recreates the feel of that set.
Oh, wow.
And that huge moving staircase, the escalator between the two worlds, took 3 months to make. Cost £3,000, which these days would be a bit shy of £120,000.
Yep.
Had 106 steps that were each 20 feet wide and was driven by a 12-horsepower engine because it was so massive. and because the machinery was so noisy, they couldn't record when the staircase was moving, they couldn't record the dialogue. So they had to record that afterwards and then dub it in post-production because this thing was so bloody noisy. Whereas, it was this beautiful flowing thing in the film itself.
Yes.
And I have another fun fact about the staircase for you. And,
please,
of course, for our listeners. The statues, who were they?
You know what? It's on the tip of my tongue. I did know one, but... what were they? Because I know that there were lots of different people in history. Who are they?
Yeah, there were 17 of them that were either seen and or mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And they're people like Alexander the Great, Beethoven, Chopin, Confucius, Benjamin Franklin, Julius Caesar, Abraham Lincoln, Michelangelo. Muhammad, you see the name of the statue, but he's not represented, which is mm-hmm. Appropriate. Moses, Plato, Rembrandt, Cardinal Richelieu, William Shakespeare, King Solomon, Jonathan Swift, and someone I don't know called Bartolome Murillo. Mm. Do you know what those 17 characters all have in common? Here's a fun quiz.
No.
At the time of the making of the film, all 17 of those famous people were believed to have been epileptic. And it's a reference to what Peter's condition is.
Oh, wow.
They are very careful not to mention epilepsy. There was a reason I've read and forgotten, I'm sorry. But the statues are a clue to that. It wasn't just famous people. It was famous people who, at least at the time, they thought had been epileptic. So that's a reference to, you know, what might be going on with Peter. And the film is very playful and it has a bit of a bet each way about, so are these visions real or not? There are things...
Yeah, absolutely.
There are things that suggest that it's all true because there are things that... Scenes up there that Peter's not in, for example, particularly at the start of the film. June falls asleep so she can be a witness in the trial as well. There are things that, you know, he couldn't have known unless he kind of reverse engineered it. But then there are things that very clearly say, no, this is actually, war trauma that's causing this brain injury, causing
well,
this
condition.
Well,
that's why I say before.
So really,
that's
it plays what, really know, nicely yeah. between the two.
It
and
does.
Then the most interesting part of all that is that the same actor plays the celestial judge and the surgeon.
Right.
Did you notice that?
No, I didn't notice that because he had a very distinctive mask on.
Oh, but he took it off at the end. He has a very distinctive face.
Right.
So is that, you know, there's a connection between the two worlds, or is that again saying that Peter's making this all up and fitting people from his life into the story? Don't know. And basically, I don't care. It's really clever how they do it. But I don't care
either. You can actually think it either way and it's still fine.
Yes.
Whether it's in his mind or not. It's interesting. We talk about actors staying still in departures.
Go on, I was going to say this.
Time stops and they have to remain still in those moments while Peter's moving around the scene.
Well, particularly the table tennis scene.
The table tennis scene, yeah. Oh, look, really great. And are they moving?
I thought that Kim Hunter deserved an Oscar for the scene where she's outside the operating theatre.
Yes.
And time is frozen. And I think it's the four guys are all standing around her up close. They're putting a flower with a sharp looking leaf up to her face to gather a teardrop.
And she doesn't move. She doesn't at all. She's so good.
And the first time I saw this film, I think I saw it on telly, the scene that really shocked me, because I was thinking, oh, this is an old film, 1940s and so on, is at one stage, some of the characters, who are ghosts basically, walk through a doorway, like a closed door.
I was going to mention that. That effect, for back then, it looks very good. They've done it really well. This the thing is, this film, I mean, I watched it on a bit of a dodgy version of it. And there are some dodgy versions. That's why I can't wait to see the...
R-rated?
The quality of the film.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
That's why I'm really looking forward to seeing a restored version. But the effects don't feel old at all because it's done with sets and it's just totally believable. It doesn't pull you out of it. It's a marvel.
And I think it'll be that really much more amazing when we see the touched up one, the restored one.
Oh, I can't wait to see that. And you know what? I'd really love to see this on a big screen,
Well, it'd be a fantastic double with It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, it'd be a perfect double. And you just leave feeling so brilliant from those two films. And they're really pure cinema. And this is pure cinema to me. It just tells the story, a beautiful story, really well. It does bring in the themes of life and death so well. Post-war trauma, the war.
The beauty of the world, because our world is in colour. And that pink-flowered grove early in the film.
Oh, yeah, very lovely.
It's stunning.
Yeah, it is. And I just found it really clever. I think the screenplay really shines in that courtroom scene. You really see the cleverness of it with some of the lines they do. And the banter between both the prosecution and the defence.
And interesting that the prosecutor, who's this mythical character who's supposed to have been the first casualty at the American War of Independence from Britain, and explains why he doesn't like the Brits, but he's played by Raymond Massey. And at that time, Raymond Massey had made maybe two or three films where he played Abraham Lincoln. So you've basically, okay, in the contemporary mind, you've got Lincoln prosecuting the Brits, which is kind of a nice overlay as well. Mm. But I've got some questions for you. Did you spot Richard Attenborough?
No. You know, I saw it in the title. I went, Richard Attenborough, I forgot he was in this. I just don't know which soldier he is.
he has one moment right at the first afterlife scenes when he sort of arrives up the escalator. And he gets like one or two lines or something. But great to see him. It was his sixth film. And I love the way the Americans, when they arrived, went straight for the Coke machine.
Yes, that's right, they did. Yes.
All right. The other question I want to ask you is, what did you make of that moment when Peter washes up on the beach and he thinks he's in heaven and there's a naked boy piping a pan flute through his goats?
That was an odd scene, but I think it's meant to be. Because you don't know whether he doesn't know whether he is in the afterlife or not, because it never returns to that, and you never see that kid again or anything like that.
Well, yeah. he was an actor; he was a local who got cast. But yeah, it's just kind of odd. Like, is it? Are they trying to imply something about, you know, a Hellenic ideal, or is it just something really weird that makes him think for a moment he is in heaven?
That's what I think.
It stands out. It's not bad, but it's just kind of odd.
Yeah, it is kind of odd, yeah. But I think that's the point. I think it's sort of meant to be.
Well, I've got two more fun facts for you. The first one is, do you know how Kim Hunter... Oh, by the way, we should say Kim Hunter is Stella in A Streetcar Named Desire.
Yes,
From the first Planet of the Apes film. But do you know how she got cast in the film?
I don't know. I love her in this film, but yeah.
So do I. She was recommended by Hitchcock. They were having problems casting the part, and she'd been doing off-camera reads to support the making of Spellbound. And right. So Hitchcock recommended her, and you're right, she's great in the part. And I really do like Maria scoring as Conductor 71.
Yes, even he's very French, but...
Yeah, but he was really pushing to play Peter.
Oh, really? No, David Niven.
And really want to play Peter, and the filmmaker said, no, it's Niven. And he kept pushing, so in the end they said to him, look... You can play the conductor, you can go, and if you go, we're going to cast Peter Ustinov. So he stayed.
Oh, wow. Okay. That would have been interesting as well.
So what is this film for you?
I'm giving it a 10.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
This is masterpiece country.
And it was such an unexpected masterpiece last year for me. I know. I didn't expect to love it as much as I did. And you're right, it is in the It's a Wonderful Life territory. And... it's just one of those films which I didn't really know that much about. This is the thing. No one really talks about this film as being such a classic for, you know, maybe they did, you know, 20, 30 years ago, whatever. But at the moment, nowadays, people don't really think about this film. They talk about Citizen Kane. They talk about Hitchcock classics. You talk about...
From their portfolio, you'll hear people talk about The Red Shoes.
Red Shoes a lot,
and very occasionally Black Narcissus.
Yes, absolutely. Hear that quite a bit.
But not much else. And this is an amazing film.
You know, I've only seen The Red Shoes as part of their film collection. I haven't seen Black Narcissus. But this is better. I just think this is such a classic. It's such a masterpiece. Everybody should watch it. And it's a really enjoyable watch.
And when you try and put yourself into the mind of its original audience, it's just got that whole other dimension and power as well.
Oh, it does. And the thing is, I think the film forces you to do that anyway. I think when you're watching it, you sort of understand that this is 1946. And that's when I thought about it the same this time as well. This is 1946. This is just after World War II. So when you're looking at all the soldiers, it kind of breaks your heart, you know, when you're seeing all these young people in heaven going up to this place of the afterlife and getting their angel wings. They look so happy, but you're also feeling that sadness as well, that all these lives have been lost. I mean, there's so many emotions that come with this within this love story. And ultimately, what it's really coming down to is that peace, love, does win in the end. I think that's the beauty of it. So that concludes our season finale of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. Greg.
That's the end of our fourth season. Like,
that's,
you know,
right.
As I think I said at the start, we're a success story now. Woo!
Well, we are going to come into our fifth season, and there will be a season five. And you know, it's always just wonderful. And in talking to you about, you know, a lot of different types of films, and we hope that you get a lot out of it as well, you know, our listeners.
And I think that you and I will look back on season four as being particularly special and remarkable, because we came into season four with a very particular set of plans for how we were going to plan out the episodes. We did have some guests. We had our sons on, which is very special in its own right.
That's right.
But we had plans to bring other people in on particular topics, and that all fell apart when the pandemic hit. It stretched out the season. It mucked up our plans, like this moment now where we're separate from each other, you know, talking about these films, for better or worse.
Yeah, it's amazing. I remember our first remote podcast recording, which felt really odd because we're so used to being together and talking together amongst one another that it felt quite isolating, you know. But now it feels quite normal, and I think that is.
Well, no, I'm sorry. It doesn't feel normal to me. I'm more used to it.
Yes,
but I'm longing to get back to our old ways. Like everyone's longing to get back to something resembling what we used to have. Yes. I'll be very glad to go back to it. But I will also look back on this season as being about resilience as well.
And I just hope that we've provided a little bit of light and something to listen
I think a matter of life and death actually speaks to us in this present moment as well. You know, we've been through a tough 18 months. It's not a war in that traditional sense. It's not gone for 6 years, but people have certainly lost loved ones in very difficult circumstances. And so I think a matter of life and death has something to say to us now as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. So thank you so much for listening and just being a part of it. We love it when we get comments and when there's some reviews or when we know that the people are listening and across the world. It makes us feel great. It makes us continue wanting to keep going.
We got our first fan email this season as well.
We did, and that was just so delightful to see as well. So, like I said, across the world, wherever you are, we love having you as our listeners. We'll choose a really good slate of films to talk about for season five. Very varied again.
Maybe a bit of controversy again.
And then, but we can't wait for that. But obviously,
and before that though, we will be back for Christmas.
We'll be back for Christmas with our annual Christmas special, so you can, and we'll be doing that, I think, from the studio, which is going to be wonderful, instead of remotely.
That'll be a celebration in its own right.
Yeah. So, look, thanks again, and look, we'll see you soon.
It's good night from me, and it's good night from him.